on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Looky here, it is the 29th day of September 2014. This is The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is where we live. Thank you, Randy. Loud and clear on iTunes on my Mac, Bob. Wonderful. Wonderful. We're even working on getting listed back at iTunes Radio, which would be wonderful as well. Ben Birch is making that effort. No, HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is where you go if you want to jump into the chat room. Folks are already wandering in, and as soon as this incredibly tired, bedraggled old computer will let me, I will be in there myself and start out the evening with our usual round of howdies. Also at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, you can get the Listen Live player. That's the easiest way to listen on a PC. Of course, if you're listening, as usual, this announcement is just perforce. It's standard boilerplate, I suppose. If you're listening on some sort of mobile, smart, Android, whatever device, then it's worth noting that any advertisements of which you may become made aware in no wise support The Horn. This is a non-commercial undertaking. It is not a profit-seeking venture. It is a 10-year-old effort to create community and conversation. As September comes to an end, we enter our anniversary month. The month of October is our anniversary month for the online-only version of this program. We passed our 10th anniversary in February, but the online-only version has its 9th anniversary coming up on October 24th. How about that? 9 years. Amazing, right? Oh, wow. Nice crowd already gathered up in the chat room now that the tired old computer has let me in. Good evening, Anatole and Carol and Devin and Jeremy and Kathy and Art Kellison and Sparky and Sentient and Tim from L.A. That's a good crowd, and hopefully it'll get even better as the evening progresses. Carol noting on Facebook, it's Moran Monday. Those are always fun. Time for some liberal, sane, and necessary. I like that word, necessary. Talk radio on The Horn. Starting now and for the next 3 hours, you can turn off the noise and just enjoy. Thank you, Carol, for those wonderful and inspiring words. Equally inspiring is the fact that we have crossed the threshold of what was an existential crisis here. We needed to raise $2,000 by the end of September, early October, and we did. Hallelujah. The bills are paid. The wolf is away from the door. The lupine pest is away from the porch. And now we just go into October with our ordinary fundraising. Thanks go out to myriad people. To Shorty from L.A. To Betsy. To Roger. To Edward. Wallace and Beth and Paul and John Diana, Patsy, another John, Trevor, Robert, Patricia, Jay Cruzen. Our good friend, Dr. Allen, Rocco, Anthony, another Robert, Todd and Kath, Ryan, Sal, Thomas, Asa, Jack, Leo, James, Lauren, Jay, Scott, Sylvia, Don, Lib. What a roll call this is. Bill, Marty, Kate, Ron, Steven, Dennis, Glenn, Jan and Jerry. I mean, this is inspiring in the extreme. This is, I sat stunned. Nervously stunned, but stunned through the course of the weekend as this unfolded. And thanks to Tom for his challenge this evening, right before airtime. I got a note from our buddy Tom in the Bay Area. He said, well, that went great on Friday. My undying appreciation to everyone who participated. After a weekend off, we're still behind. So here comes Tom's Moran Monday back on your heads challenge. Can we triple my $100? Let's give it a try. So that is on the table this evening. Tom, who already put forward a challenge on Friday, is trying to get us out front a little bit. And I'll tell you what that's going to be, straight up. I mentioned this last week. I've been digging around, trying to do some research. Because one of the things I want to do is to get traditional telephony back hooked up to the horn. Specifically, so that we can bring our buddy Bill, Mr. Stress, in Cleveland, back into the Friday on the Front Porch conversation, because he can't participate right now because he can only call in via a telephone number, and that doesn't work the way the Skype group works on Fridays now. So if we can meet Tom's challenge this evening, I'm going to set that aside in pursuit of the gizmo that will allow us to have a traditional phone line connection, so that Mr. Stress and others can have participation in Friday on the Front Porch. Because in the long run, this community is about access, and it is about trying to provide access to as many people as humanly possible. And that, and we can put that process underway by doing things like meeting Tom's challenge, and then we'll start ordinary fundraising again on October 1. The equipment cost to do this is around $700. So we'll be almost halfway there if Tom's challenge is met this evening. So we'll call that not only the kicking the lupine pest off the porch challenge from Tom this evening, but the what do we call it? The community access upgrade as well. Yeah, Randy asks, what happened? Did someone send up the bat signal? And yes, someone did. Our dear friend Mike Malloy sent up the bat signal. And a lot of the truth seekers, and of course there's a lot of crossover between the truth seekers and the Horn Family Commune congregation, pitched in to help push this beast back away from our threshold. And so thanks also go to Mike and Kathy Malloy. It is they are dear friends, beyond dear. And this is an amazing community taken all together. Because, among other things, this speaks to the hunger that people have for open, accessible, non-corporate communication. And that is and always has been and always will be the mission of the Horn. So if you want to jump in on Tom's challenge, either PayPal or traditional mail is fine. The PayPal button's at headonradionetwork.com. So too is the traditional mail address, which I will now repeat for those who do not wish to go to the website, even though we appreciate the traffic. It is The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318 Beckley, Beckley, WV 25801, with the reminder that checks and money orders should not be made payable to Bob Kincaid, but rather should be made payable to Head On Communications, The Horn, something like that, which Boss Man Wayne can then deal with. Because I don't see it. He does. And if you want to participate by mail, just shoot me a note, and we will, let Boss Man Wayne know that he doesn't have to wear his spider-proof gloves or his hearing protection against the mailbox echo when he goes to check the mail. So I hope that updates us roundly and soundly. And frankly, I hope we can move toward getting the gizmo and getting Mr. Stress back into Friday on the front porch. He is much beloved of this community and much missed in our Friday conversations because he's particularly fun when he's working in a group. Anybody who ever saw him play the blues in Cleveland knows that. All right, guess what? It is, well, you already know. Good God, you lived through the weekend. It's Moran Monday on the Horn. Oh, yes, indeed. How can one forget? So, we've got the Calliope music we play on Moran Monday. And, we've got the wonderful clip from Blazing Saddles that we play on Moran Monday. I think we're going to have to add this clip. This is a clip via Americans Against the Tea Party of John Cleese, Python, discussing, well, he's discussing the very essence of Moran Monday, really, when it comes right down to it. You're going to love this. Now, when we, in the future, when we run it for Moran Monday purposes, we'll cut it down considerably, because this is a longish clip. But, this is the very essence of what we deal with on Moran Monday.
Is that they are so stupid.
Wait.
That they have.
I want to make. He gets right at it from the very beginning, so I want to make sure we get it right. All right, I'm going to have to reload the page. Dadgummit. I told you, the computer is old and tired. My knees are blind, my eyes are weak. You know, straight out of a Python bit. Working. Oh, someday, someday, someday. Yeah, me too, Carol. Carol noting, he had me at, they are so stupid. And that's probably going to be the clip, you know, that we carve out in the future. But mercy sakes. This is just perfect.
I think the problem with people like this is that they are so stupid that they have no idea how stupid they are. You see, if you're very, very stupid, how can you possibly realize that you're very, very stupid? You'd have to be relatively intelligent to realize how stupid you are. There's a wonderful bit of research by a guy called David Dunning at Cornell, who's a friend of mine, I'm proud to say, who's pointed out that in order to know how good you are at something requires exactly the same skills as it does to be good at that thing in the first place, which means, and this is terribly funny, that if you're absolutely no good at something at all, then you lack exactly the skills that you need to know that you're absolutely no good at it. And this explains not just Hollywood, but almost the entirety of Fox News.
You've got to remember that these are just simple farmers. These are people of the land. You know, morons.
Hurry, step right up, that's right, it's Moran Monday on the Horn. Here, behind this thin cybernetic veil of cybernetic tent cloth, you will find Morans of all shapes, all sizes, all genders, all persuasions. Well, no, mostly it's right-wing Morans. Yes, indeed, ladies and gentlemen, kiddies and cousins, children of all ages who should at all times be protected because the Morans, well, they're Morans. We have Morans for your delectation this evening. We have right-wing Morans. We have birthers Morans, deather Morans, tenther Morans, booger-eater Morans, John Birch Morans, libertarian Morans, and repig-licking Morans. You can't tell the Morans without a program, and this is the program that tells the Morans. You just can't tell them much. As previously advised, women, men, with children, bags, purses, anything you care to hang on to, keep them close by your body as you pass through the Moran Monday tent, as the Morans can get grabby. Head for the hills, or you'll be up to your armpits in Morans.
Oh, God, it's no joke. It's like they went into overdrive, and this is before we ever even consider the Values Voter Summit. Holy mackerel! It's an infestation. There's no getting away from them. He's kind of grandfathered out, but this one sort of begs for a treatment, because it's not so much that Bill O'Reilly is the Moran. We know Bill O'Reilly is a Moran. But what in the sweet name of me running persuaded somebody at This Week with George Snuffleupagus to invite Bill O'Reilly onto that program? I mean, that's their Sunday news show, right? Since when do they have do they bring on the folks who wear the big red rubber noses and the floppy shoes? Oh, wait. Since forever. I guess we're going to have to kill the Moran Monday music. This really does, however, beg for the Calliope underneath. I guess it's the first of the week and everything. We may as well go ahead and issue the first duct tape and hockey puck warning. By the way, explorations are underway to see if we could see what it would take to get some official horn, hockey pucks, and duct tape out there. And then we could all take pictures of us with our horn, hockey pucks, and duct tape. And just, I don't know. But wouldn't that be fun? It's a question of what it would take to manufacture and drop ship and yada, yada, yada. And maybe use them as premiums for the program for people who do keep this thing going. I don't want to get lost in the weeds here before we wander off to ABC and Bill O'Reilly, but I can tell you it's a craptastic thing to be putting up with this with nary a drop of tequila nor a swirly straw in sight. All right, so here's the setup. Bill O'Reilly has begun a few years ago this shtick of writing books. I mean, this is, after all, the guy who referred to Dr. Tiller as Tiller the Killer and whipped up a right-wing frenzy until someone decided to take him up on the offer and blew away Dr. Tiller at church, mind you, in Kansasstan. So the shtick, which Bill O'Reilly now works, is that he's got a series of books that begin with the word killing. The goddess of irony never takes a day off. There's been Killing Lincoln, Killing Jesus, Killing Kennedy. I think for him it's... Am I going to sit here and tell you that I know for a fact that there is a loofah involved as he dictates this stuff? See what I did there? Just checking. I mean, I don't want to work blue or anything, but, well, go listen to the falafel tape. Oh, give you a glass of wine in the shower and work you over with a falafel. Well, his new book is called, and for some reason or another, is there a mystery here? I mean, okay, there are things that are not and perhaps may never be known about the murder of Abraham Lincoln. Granted. Although, in light of the fact that a crime analyst and scientist has recently declared the identity of Jack the Ripper, there's hope. So there's that. And we all know that controversy and questions abound with regard to the killing of John Kennedy. All right, so there's that. Jesus? Well, I mean, I guess you can say that there are unanswered questions, because, hell, there's an unanswered question as to whether Yeshua, the brown-skinned Palestinian day laborer and itinerant semi-literate rabbi, actually existed. So, okay, that's the side of the street that Bill O'Reilly has decided to work. Because when you are as big a jackass as Bill O'Reilly, you're constantly in, you know, it's not that he doesn't have enough money. The man's got enough money to burn a sopping wet herd of elephants with sopping wet $100 bills. But he's looking for some sort of legitimacy, some sort of, dare we say it, scholarly respect. I couldn't get finished with the phrase. Scholarly respect. Academic, no. Well, he wants the rubes to think he's smart. He wants to put out books that dumb people would think are smart. You know, in line with the John Cleese clip. So far, so good. So now he's got the new book, the new killing book out. I know that swirly straw's around here somewhere. Killing Patton. If you listen very, very carefully, you can probably hear Jim and Bill almost in unison. Kicking furniture. Killing! What? He had a car wreck! Because we've all seen the movie. George C. Scott walks off toward some alp with a bull terrier ambling along beside him. And he talks about the days, George C. Scott's narration, using the voice he developed for Dr. Strangelove, by the way. Narrating how Roman emperors of old, when they had their triumphs, would have a slave riding behind them in the chariot, holding a wreath over their head and whispering always, "Remember, you are mortal." And his death in a car accident was foreshadowed by him being narrowly missed by a car. That way the director of the film got away without having to show Patton's car wreck, but giving us a hint of what was to come. And had he lived, Patton's goal was to start a brand new war with the Soviet Union while they were what he deemed to be on their knees. "Mr. President, they'll never see it coming. Yeah, they won't even see the big board." Sorry, that's Dr. Strangelove. So that's the setup to all of this moranity. Killing Patton. Which leads to the obvious and inevitable question, who done it? Well, for lucky viewers of This Week with George Snuffleupagus, warning, spoiler alert, okay? Oh, Jesus.
General Patton interested me because he was the last no-spin general. Just no BS. Right at you. Got him killed, but he...
Do you really believe that?
Yes.
The official record says Patton died after a car accident on a hunting trip. But O'Reilly's new book, Killing Patton, suggests a darker conspiracy.
I think Stalin killed him. Patton was going to go back to the United States and condemn Stalin and the Soviet Union, tell the American people, these guys aren't going out of Poland, they're going to try to take over the world. And Stalin wanted him dead, and I think Stalin got him dead.
All the evidence is there, including the driver who was with him that day, is that it was a spur-of-the-moment decision to go see this castle before hunting. There's no way anybody could have known.
But you have to take into consideration that Patton was being tracked by Soviet intelligence.
He also had round-the-clock guards in his hospital room.
He had round-the-clock guards who were worried about the press. They weren't worried about anybody else. His wife was in the hospital room with him.
Right there.
Right. And he's having cognac, and he's laughing with the nurses, and he goes to sleep, and he wakes up dead.
Why the doctor who reviewed the record said it was completely consistent with a pulmonary embolism.
No autopsy? They couldn't get him in the ground fast enough.
But his wife didn't want an autopsy, right?
At the moment, she didn't, but then she asked, and she herself launched an investigation.
How could you really investigate it now?
You can investigate it because of DNA evidence. Stalin had a factory that produced traceless poisons back then.
Stop. Just stop. Did you catch that last sentence? And I'm not going to go back and play it again. Stalin had a factory that produced traceless poisons, which Bill O'Reilly, and with his superior science mind and maybe some X-ray vision or, I don't know, some sort of superpower, is now going to trace and detect. And again, the Moran nomination is not for Bill O'Reilly. The Moran nomination is for A, George, whoever books for George Snuffleupagus, bringing him on the program. Was there whining involved? Oh, please, please, can't Bill come play with George? Oh, he's got a really goofy, stupid book. He's going to claim that Stalin had George Patton bumped off. Oh, come on, it'll be fun. He can fling poo and everything. Please, for the love of Christ, do not buy this book. No, pretty please, do not buy this book. Of course, I don't have to worry about you. Well, then again, who the hell am I? Maybe you want it for the schlock value. Maybe you want it for the laughs. I don't know. Apparently, this is not being lost on the Horn Family Commune congregation. A note from Michael in Madison. Damn, Bob! I never put that all together. Billows, Tiller, the Killer Cries, and his Killing So-and-So books. How come someone hasn't written a book called Killing Tiller, blatantly ripping off his gimmick to highlight Billow's role in whipping up the bloodlust? Seems like a no-brainer. Any author journalists out there? Take my book title, please. And, of course, O'Reilly would then bluster and threaten to sue, and the publishers wouldn't want to touch it because, well, you know, I mean, it wouldn't be nice to be mean to the wingnut. Because they're wingnuts, and they just do that stuff. Now, to be fair to Michael, what I think would be a far more interesting book would be a book that and there would have to be some serious research time involved, a book that would examine the right-wing media connection to any number of a host of killings in this country, or near killings. You know, the guy who listened to the Beckerhead squeal and on and on about the Tides Foundation and progressivism until he got himself full of liquid courage and headed off to San Francisco to go and protect freedom. Only he got so liquored up he got busted on the way with a whole bunch of guns. Or Mr. Jim David Adkisson, was that his name, in Tennessee, who had a house full of Bill O'Reilly and Michael Savage and Bernie Goldberg and Rush Limbaugh, who left a manifesto saying, yep, went to kill me some liberals. Robert in Australia. Does O'Reilly make this crap up as he goes along? Not really, Robert. He makes it up as he drinks along.
Well, I've got an idea. Hey, let's do a book
Let's do a book about killing Jesus. And Roger Ailes is over there at Fox News TV radio. Roland, again. Ah, that'll be great, Billy, old sot you. Robert in Morgantown, I fear for your sanity, because I think you're way out in front of O'Reilly's brain. Be careful, okay? I mean, take a walk or something, get some fresh air, because anytime you delve that deeply into the swamp, there's going to be trouble. Robert pointing out, maybe O'Reilly will be telling us Al-Qaeda killed Princess Di in his next book. Sure could help this religious war effort. And I'm not going to play you the clip I found earlier today of Joe Scarborough. The pollen is still just hell for this time. Placidus! Excuse me. Of Joe Scarborough going booga 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 booga, absolutely, utterly, completely convinced that it's ISIS. ISIS has done found more Oklahoma, and the headloppers are here. I give halt. It's too much to behold. So, in case you were, pulmonary embolism is just what they called it when Stalin killed Patton. He had one of his evil commie spies infiltrate that hospital, and, I mean, yeah, it was a pulmonary embolism, all right. They just stuck a needle full of air into his arm and pumped a big old bubble in there, and away he went off to the choir eternal. Dang. Kevin in Colorado Springs. Bob, I really think Bill O'Reilly's onto something there with the patent conspiracy, total absurdity and stupidity. Perhaps his book will sell as not well as Palin's book did. P.S. If folks can answer the challenge, make that two lines for Friday on the front porch. My Skype accessibility went long ago, and so far not one of the disability organizations or the company itself has even offered to help me solve the problem. Cheers, though. 10 years is a decade, and pretty soon a decade turns into a century, meaning, of course, that when all of us in the Horn family commune are long dead and gone, there will be many generations of family members to follow us in keeping the show and the movement of common sense alive and well. One hopes. One hopes. And I really, we'll do what we can. We'll do what we can. But the gizmo I have in mind only does one line. And then there's fixing the other gizmo, which might, well, baby steps. Baby steps. And big thanks. Big thanks to Terrace. Note coming in. Terrace says, fuck the Koch brothers and contribute to the Horn now before it's gone and we're all unemployed. Thank you very much, Terrace. Thanks to poor tired computer. We'll get there in a second. Thanks to Michael as well. We are more than halfway towards the toward Tom's triple your money challenge. he put out 100 and wanted to see it tripled. It's not really a challenge, I guess, but I mean, you know what I mean. And that will go toward enhancing the telephone accessibility of the program. So you get the idea that Moran Monday is kind of busy. Yeah, like I said, without even making reference, even without making reference to the Values Voter Summit. Thank you. And I'm looking, just saw a contribution come across, and I want to make sure we get this right. Not sure who that is. Drop me a note, just so I can thank you appropriately. Twisted. That's what it says. Twisted. Yeah. Michael and Madison with a suggestion. Dillo's next book, Killing Reagan. How the Ruskies and/or liberals conspired to smuggle lead-poisoned jelly beans into the White House, rapidly poisoning the brain of America's greatest American since Jesus himself. Oh, I can see that happening. Between killing Al-Qaeda killing Princess Di over here and killing Reagan, Billow's Ghost Rider is going to be busy for a while. Oh, okay. Robert, you've got a fan. Michael notes, by the way, I also, I love the killing die idea, too. So many killings. So little time for falafel. That's what they killed her with! The driver was lured by the taste-tempting smell of falafel and tzatziki, cucumber dill yogurt sauce, and he was reaching to dip that deep-fried yummy goodness into the tzatziki and lost control, and wham! Another Al-Qaeda plot. Coming soon from Wingnut Press, Bill O'Reilly, Killing Princess Di. Oh, God. So you see, like, no. Okay, so Morans, we're going to have to go to North Carolina stand for this one. Oh, Ron, are you out there? Jacksonville, Onslow County, North Carolina. A man's been cited for accidentally shooting another man at a farm shop in Jacksonville over the weekend. Jeremy Snyder, 35, of Jacksonville, received a citation for discharging a firearm within city limits, according to the Jacksonville Police Department. The accidental shooting happened at Guerrilla Armament. Investigators said Snyder and 28-year-old Douglas Clapp, no, really, were both handling a weapon when the gun was discharged. Clapp was hit and taken to Onslow Memorial Hospital. He was later transferred to New Hanover Regional Medical Center. Police said Sunday Clapp was in serious condition, but he has since been upgraded to good condition, investigators said Monday morning. Hmm. No, really. What? The, okay, so this is one of those little journalism Moran Monday moments. What does it mean when it says that Snyder and Clapp were both handling a weapon when the gun was discharged? Now, don't blame me. I've already been there in my mind. You can go there, too. Soft, George. Tell me about the rabbits. That's right, Lenny. Just keep stroking the firearm out here. I'll help you stroke the firearm. Bang! Trying to work in a dose of the clap joke into this, but I haven't quite gotten there yet. I'll leave that up to the comedy writing team of the Horn. Because the tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of gun fondlers at the gun shop down in Jacksonville, North Carolina. I mean, really. How do two people fondle a gun at the same time? Because I'm running and have been ever since reading this story. I'm running several scenarios in my mind, none of which are not absolutely mind-bogglingly effing creepy. I want to buy that there shooting gun. No, I want to buy that there shooting gun. You got lead in my body. You got your body in my lead. Two great tastes that taste great together. I mean, easy, boys, easy. You can each fondle the weapon separately, but we like it better if we fondle it together. Jesus, and they wonder why they get called homosexuals. Just another Monday. Just another Monday. One of these days I'm going to get around to writing that, you know, that parody lyric to, who was it, the Bangles? Just another Manic Monday. Just another Moran Monday. Yeah. And it goes on and on and on. We will all just be sitting around by about 2 hours and 12 minutes from now. This is crazy. By the way, speaking of Morans, as we are, have any of you seen, because I did, you know, I sneak out on the weekends, and I go and sit at a local publican's establishment because they have large televisions, and I watch college football. What in the sweet name of F gives with the Koch brothers ads on TV? And by the way, this is a determined, deliberate campaign. In other words, it's working. Enough people have begun to learn what a sleazy gang of anti-American, what a sleazy pair of anti-American thugs the Koch brothers are, but now they're beginning to worry about the PR of it. I mean, we know they're behind voter suppression efforts. More on that, if you'll remind me. We know that they're behind Americans for Prosperity and oodles of teabaggers. We know that they're doing everything that they possibly can to destroy the idea of self-government in the United States. We know that they're behind, for instance, otherwise insignificant races for political office in West Virginia and Iowa. Hog castrator Joni Ernst in Iowa got dinged for being a little camp follower to the Koch brothers in Indianola, Iowa over the weekend during a debate, and she didn't like it one bit. And she's told, what's his name, Braley, her Democratic opponent, she's, well, you get money from that California billionaire who thinks global warming is real. I am a veteran, and how dare you? If you see the clip, and I don't have it handy, if you see the clip from the debate, you will notice that, and I think it's, I personally think it's deliberate. You'll notice the speech pattern. Right, hardcore right-wing teabagging female candidates adopt the Palin-esque speech patterns and word usage. Things like, of our great American United States country. Because I guess that kind of dim-witted vocabulary, not our great nation, but of the sort of jangly use of that and our, just pay attention going down as we go forward. Oh, but no, she didn't like it one bit. And meanwhile, the Koch brothers are poor. Can you imagine pouring millions of dollars into political races in a little state like West Virginia? Well, they are. The Repiglicans already have and are not going to lose their majority in the House of Representatives. And yet they are pouring ungodly amounts of money, the Koch brothers are, into trying to unseat perennial incumbent Congressman Nick Joe Rahal. Wouldn't it be handy if Nick Joe Rahal could get, oh, a bunch of progressives excited about keeping him in Congress? Not interested. Not any more interested in having progressives vote for him than Natalie Tennant is in having progressives vote for her. Because it's just coal, 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 coal. But no, the Koch brothers, people have figured out who the hell they are. And lots of Americans now know that they mean America no good. And so it was with some bemusement that I noticed that they're running ads for Koch Industries nationally. I don't know if they're still running, but they have been. Ads for job openings with Koch Industries. And if you'll just take this flaming pen and sign the contract with your own blood, no, don't worry about the fact that it immediately catches fire and burns into the page. That's just so the contract can be recorded in the infernal regions with old Scratch. But there's that. And then, via the program, in the morning program that proves that MSNBC is not a liberal network, you had a segment in which, I kid you not, this morning, Joe Scarborough, excuse me, Joe Scarborough said that, by God, he was about tired of having people talk mean about the Koch brothers, because they are two fine, upstanding Americans. And he doesn't understand why people are upset about the Koch brothers. Because, I mean, they're more like they're out of the Rand Paul libertarian mode. I mean, he said that as if that was somehow an amelioration of their filthy, sleazy nature. No, he really did. And then he said, well, yeah, if you enjoy the arts, you like the Koch brothers. If you think technology is great, you like the Koch brothers. If you get cancer and go to the hospital, you like the Koch brothers. Like Edith, huh? No, really. So the word has gone out. The Koch brothers have mounted a charm offensive because so many people have found out what it is they do and do to America. And by the way, no single piece of journalism does a better job of that than what you will find over at RollingStone.com. Tim Dickinson has the article. It's dated last week, September 24th. It is called, and it's online. It's available online. Inside the Koch Brothers' Toxic Empire. Here's a few highlights. Under the nearly five-decade reign of CEO Charles Koch, the company has paid out record civil and criminal environmental penalties. And in 1999, a jury handed down to Koch's pipeline company what was then the largest wrongful death judgment of its type in U.S. history, resulting from the explosion of a defective pipeline that incinerated a pair of Texas teenagers. The volume of Koch Industries' toxic output is staggering. According to the University of Massachusetts Amherst's Political Research Institute, liberals, only three companies rank among the top 30 polluters of America's air, water, and climate: ExxonMobil, American Electric Power, and Koch Industries. Hey, American Electric Power? Why, they own Appalachian Power. Gosh. Every time I turn on the lights, I'm helping American Electric Power be the number two polluter in the United States. They certainly are number two. Thanks in part to its 2005 purchase of paper mill giant Georgia-Pacific, Koch Industries dumps more pollutants into the nation's waterways than General Electric and International Paper combined. The company ranks 13th in the nation for toxic air pollution. Koch's climate pollution, meanwhile, outpaces oil giants including Valero, Chevron, and Shell. Across its businesses, Koch generates 24 million metric tons of greenhouse gases per year. Tim Dickinson noting that the cost of all of this is borne by communities in cities like Port Arthur, Texas, where a Koch-owned facility produces as much as 2 billion pounds of petrochemicals every year. This past March, they signed a consent decree with the Department of Justice requiring Koch Industries to spend more than $40 million to bring that one plant into compliance with the Clean Air Act. Because it wasn't in compliance with the Clean Air Act. Charming, huh? And so, yeah, these well-meaning polluters are just good Americans who deserve your love, right? Sure. They want to give you a job. Yeah, they really want to give you a job. They want to do a job on you. This article is really worth your time. It is long, and there's no way to do it justice here. there's a passage where they talk about something that was developed and trademarked by Koch Industries, market-based management. It really is. It's trademarked by Koch Industries. They first started pushing it in 1991. Kim Dickinson notes in the article, to incentivize workers, Coke gives employees bonuses that correlate to the value they create for the company. Salary is viewed only as an advance on compensation for value, and compensation has an unlimited upside. Really? Unlimited? Under market-based management, Coke Industries books opportunity costs, profits foregone from a missed opportunity, as though they were actual losses on the balance sheet. If you work for Coke, what Tim Dickinson notes is that means that if you play it safe, you're not going to make any money. You got to take those risks. You got to get out there and do some hardcore polluting if you want to really, really cash in big with the Coke boys. And Tim Dickinson documents spill after spill after spill after spill. Coke wasn't just cutting corners on its pipelines. It was also violating federal environmental law in other corners of the empire. Through much of the 1990s at its Pine Bend refinery in Minnesota, Coke spilled up to 600,000 gallons of jet fuel into wetlands near the Mississippi River, even increasing its discharges on weekends when it knew it wasn't being monitored. I don't want to see anybody dumping poison into the Mississippi River wetlands of Minnesota if there's anybody watching. In 2000, Koch Industries was busted in a 97-count indictment over Clean Air Act violations. This was from humongous releases of benzene into the air from their refinery in Corpus Christi, Texas. Body of Christ. Gotta love it. Followed, of course, by the ever-present cover-up. Coke Industries filed documents with Texas regulators. Ha! Regulators in Texas. Ha! Oh, you know, I love the subtle humor. They said they'd only released 0.61 metric tons of benzene in 1995. And that was just a tenth of what the law allowed. Uh-oh. It turns out they were, what's the word I'm looking for? Lying! Their actual emissions in 1995 were 91 metric tons, 15 times the legal limit. Then there was the pipeline that had almost countless leaks. A pipeline that carried liquid butane running through a neighborhood subdivision ruptured, and the creek bed filled with butane vapor. And then a pickup truck went by, and the ignition, or not went by, it started up, and the ignition, well, it involves an electrical transfer, and it went off like a bomb. When they inspected that pipeline, inspectors found 538 corrosion defects. Koch Industries only fixed 80 of them. Like I said, it is a very long article. And it will... It'll set your hair on fire. Not literal. might well want to read it, though, because it's nice to know who it is we're up against. And that article explains why Joe Scarborough pushes. Excuse me. Yeah, nose is running like a sugar tree. Explains why he went on his tirade in defense of, well, if you like the ballet, you like the Koch brothers. Do you like PBS? When you like the Koch brothers. But the other one that just sort of blew my mind that I saw on Football Saturday was an ad that is subtly, and it really, it doesn't, you know, there's no connection to reality. Well, I mean, of course, it's a right-wing ad. But, I mean, it's not connected to a political campaign. It's not connected to anybody running for office, nothing. There's just a little notation down in the corner where you see the National Rifle Association logo, and you've got this woman driving a pickup truck who says, I hate that goddamn Michael Bloomberg. That shit-sucking son of a bitch. Or, I mean, that's the upshot of what she's saying. That Michael Bloomberg said that out here in Colorado, we ain't got any roads. You tell that goddamn liberal Michael Bloomberg who tried to take away your soda pop and your junk food and your guns, you tell that Michael Bloomberg to stay back in New York where he damn well needs to stay, some bitch. No, those are not the exact words, but that's what my mind heard. I hate that piece. Yeah. And it's being done, and of course it's delivered by a tough Western woman driving a pick-em-up truck, and she doesn't have any accent. She speaks with all the flat with all the flat affect and flat accent of a hired actress, which she is, which the NRA never bothers to mention. It's not a campaign ad, and yet it is a campaign ad, and it may very well reflect a new trend in campaign adding. They're not telling anybody to vote for somebody or to vote against somebody. They're just. Well, you know, it's kind of like when the mob shows up and says, hey, I heard you didn't pay your protection this week. Huh? You know, those are some nice kids you got there. Be a shame if anything happened to them. It's that kind of messaging. Yeah, you know, hey, we're not going to say nothing. I mean, there ain't no threats here. We're just the NRA, you know? Maybe Michael Bloomberg might want to not say so much about flyover country. Be a shame if something happened to him, wouldn't it? That's how that works. Well, I have filibustered right past the top of the hour. Great group going in the chat room this evening. Hey, Anatole. Hey, Bowden. Carol's there. Devin. Doctor Who. Good evening. Good evening, Jay Cruzen. Good evening, Jeremy. John CDN. Kathy Kelly. R. Kellison. Texas T. Tim from L.A. Todd, Waggy, and Will in Chicago. And there's plenty of room for you if you want to jump in. The conversation is moving along smartly in more ways than one. And we are making progress on Tom's Keep the Lupine Pest Off the Porch Challenge, which we are going to dedicate to the creation of space for so that, among others, Mr. Stress can participate in Friday on the Front Porch. Thanks to Jay Cruzen for chipping in. We are now at $170 toward the $300 that combined with what Tom put forward that we'll put toward that fund. So we are getting very, very close indeed. Ultimately, we'll be ultimately the whole little technical setup is going to be about $700, and this will get us pretty close to halfway. A couple of notes coming in from Michael and Madison. Yet another future billow book, Killing Jobs. How a conspiracy of Chinese and Japanese electronics magnates used nanotechnology and corrupt Obamacare stormtroopers to sabotage the many livers of America's greatest inventor since, strike that, Jesus himself. Yeah, no, we're not talking about him killing employment. We're talking about Steve Jobs. And with the current, with the kerfuffle over the release of the new iPhone, Michael and I had a little exchange the other day of Tim Cook with a sort of mental image of Tim Cook dressed up as Princess Leia saying, "Help us, Obi-Jobs Kenobi. You're our only hope." And Michael pointed out that, you know, now, and that would mean, you know, the nice little round Mac Pro towers dressed up, one of them done up as R2-D2. Yeah. Love it. Michael points out, "I first noticed a Koch Industries ad during a Packers game a few weeks ago. Everyone in the ad looked friendly and was smiling, but I found the ad absolutely terrifying. They seemed to be bragging that they have their hand in just about every industry known to man, their fingers in every product anyone of us ever uses, and that you'd never know because you won't see the Koch name. I was waiting for the narrator's voice to turn cybernetic and conclude with, 'We are the Koch. Resistance is futile. Your biological and technological distinctiveness will be added to our own. Visit cokejobs.org for more details.'" Yeah, and that's ubiquity is a part of the Koch model, and it's a part of the capitalist model as well. Because what it does is it does exactly what Michael's talking about. It forces your participation in their filthy business, whether you like it or not. You may not mean to, you may not want to, but you almost default to it. I mentioned filthy business. Well, here, check it out. Go to your bathroom, not right now, but, you know, when the urge strikes, and just check the package of your toilet paper. Does it say Georgia Pacific on it? Then yes. The Koch brothers really are involved in filthy business in your house. Now, maybe that provides a little bit of, sort of Schadenfreude pleasure, knowing that if you purchase Georgia Pacific toilet paper, you're literally wiping your bum with the Koch brothers. But they get to cash a check out of it. That's how far down the rabbit hole they are. Really? So thanks to Twisted Records and Jay Cruzen and Terrace and Tom. And oh, for heaven's sakes. I just want to make sure we get all this right. And Michael, for getting us very nearly to matching Tom's call and what we will dedicate to some technology to make the horn a little more accessible. I tell you what, we are at 16 minutes past the hour. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
And how are you this evening?
I'm well, Jim. How are you?
Okay. I just placed a meatloaf in the oven.
Oh, tasty.
Yeah. And pursuant to this business with Bill O'Reilly.
Yeah, I had a feeling that might get under your skin.
I saw Mr. O'Reilly on Don Imus last week, and even Imus, and he can be pretty much a shock jock and let people have it when he doesn't agree with things. He was pretty sheepish when he interviewed O'Reilly. Didn't have a lot to say. Just basically let him discuss his book. And O'Reilly admitted to, like, having three ghostwriters.
I'm surprised there aren't, a short ton.
Who would provide grist for his mill, so to speak. So it's just amazing, you know. This guy is quite remarkable. I feel.
You are steeped, Jim. You are dipped by the heel in the history of that era.
Well,
I mean,
I'm not exactly.
Well, I mean, you know that stuff. Is this just the product of Bill O'Reilly and a liter of old Panther Piss whiskey looking for the next book? I mean, is there anything out there, even at the time he died, was there anything to suggest that this was anything other than a hollow accident?
Bob, there have been so many things that have been attributed to the demise of General Patton. I mean, there was a movie in which Max von Sydow was the one who caught him in the net with a rubber bullet. And, I'll say this about General Patton. I mean, my late uncle, fought in the Battle of the Bulge, and, you know, he had no love for Patton because they were practically tasked to do the impossible. But nonetheless, you know, his motto was, his blood, our guts. And, of course, you know, Patton, and I'll say this, and this is my opinion, Patton was his own worst enemy, or his mouth was his own worst enemy. He had made a lot of enemies, and he had caused a lot of consternation up and down his chain of command. I mean, even in the movie, I don't know if the conversation ever took place, but Beadle Smith, I think, was his, like, intermediary between...
Yeah, between Patton and Ike.
Power.
Yeah.
And, Patton was wanting to go ahead and go for the Russians. And basically what George Patton wanted to do was to stay in that uniform. That's exactly what he wanted to do.
And he wanted to remain at war.
Exactly. And
I mean, he rather enjoyed it, didn't he?
He did. In the movie, he did. Yes. Yes, he did. And I think the movie is a fairly good portrayal of his character. And he basically, in so doing, was, number one, a brilliant tactician. Extremely adept in the handling of mechanized warfare. I mean, you know, he had, in fact, studied General Rommel's book.
Rommel, you magnificent bastard, I read your book. Yeah, the line from the movie.
I mean, you know, Field Marshal Rommel was one of Patton's worthy adversaries. And it caused Patton a lot of problems when they landed in North Africa and afterwards. But nonetheless, of course, you know, because Hitler, basically after Stalingrad had, even before, had just regarded North Africa as a sideshow, which helped Patton a lot. And of course, the British, SAS had contributed a great deal to, planning some type of corps with secret orders about Sicily and Sardinia. And, you know, plus when Patton hit Sicily, he had a lot of help from the mafia and stuff like that. But nonetheless,
not to mention Field Marshal Montgomery.
Well, he and Monty were not exactly the best of friends. I mean, both
they didn't get together for pinochle on Thursdays.
No, they were both pretty much two prima donnas, and so Patton was. What I'm trying to say is he was extremely outspoken and said a lot of things he shouldn't have. Of course, slapping that soldier in Sicily. Well, it could have helped won the war. Probably did. But he was pretty much, he was extremely vitriolic in his criticism of just about everything. He had made a lot of enemies, is what I'm trying to say. And, you know, my opinion is this, you know, what O'Reilly says is, I take with many grains of salt
and probably two or three shots of a potent potable.
Oh, well, yeah, not really. I've been through the whole that too many times, as far as, you know, a lot of things in this world are concerned. But what I'm trying to say is, if Stalin would have wanted Patton killed, he could have done it. There's no possibility. There's no doubt about it. I mean, he had Beria, and Beria was the one in charge of his laboratories. As to generating secret poisons and stuff like that. But as far as Joseph Stalin is concerned, I think pretty much he had achieved basically at that time what he wanted to achieve through dealings with Churchill. And of course, at Yalta, the last conference attended by Roosevelt when he was so sick.
Yeah.
Churchill and Stalin basically had made a deal, and Churchill called it his naughty thing, in which he would give Stalin so many percentages of so many countries and stuff like that. So I think the thing was pretty much spent.
Right, so where was the percentage in bumping him off?
Patton?
Yeah.
Well, who knows? Who knows?
That's what I'm getting at, Jim. We're talking about the cobweb-filled falafel-addled mind of Bill O'Reilly.
Oh well, who knows? I mean, I can't understand that, but I think that Patton basically, as far as being there in the hospital after his accident, with his head surrounded by a pair of Crutchfield tongs. Was really in any shape to have been drinking a whole lot of cognac or whatever. If it is, I never saw that. Maybe they gave him that to relax him. Well, he's a pretty active fellow. And it was, to tell you the truth, I'm very sorry about what happened to General Patton, but because he made tremendous contributions to the war in defeating Nazi Germany. There's no question about it. And he would have gone straight for Berlin. Of course, Ike had to be the diplomat, and he had to, well, the Russians, they were the ones who wanted it, and they got it. As a matter of fact, when they took Berlin, it cost them 300,000 men.
And from a strategic point of view, where Eisenhower was concerned, let them do it.
Well, it was about all he could do, because the Russians, basically, on the face of continental Europe, they had, or Eastern Europe, had contributed to our victory in that war. We could not have won it without them. As I said before on this program, for every 8 German soldiers killed, the Russians killed 7.
Yeah.
And they lost a lot of people in so doing. But, you know, if Stalin wanted to do it, he could have done it. There's no question about it. I mean, he had inroads in through many networks and stuff like that.
But there's no evidence to suggest that he did want to.
Oh, Stalin would have loved to have done Patton then, because Patton wanted to continue the thing. But, at the end of the war, the Russian people were tired. And I think they had basically achieved what they wished to achieve, as I said before. And O'Reilly is simply an opportunist who is trying to make money and establish himself as some sort of academic dilettante, for lack of a better term. I could use that, but I'm not gonna insult anyone's ear. But I don't think so. But, and then again, Patton, as O'Reilly has pointed out, when I heard the explanation of his book on Imus, he had made many enemies in his own chain of command, and the suggestion was he was too dangerous to allow to come back to America for potential political things. But good Lord, could you imagine George Patton being elected president if he had come back?
Was it relative to the age of Eisenhower, though? He was kind of too old, wasn't he?
George?
Yeah.
No, he wasn't that old. He was in his 60s. He was a young man. Probably younger than Ike. I'm not sure. I'm sure someone will correct me on this, but... he was extremely vigorous and good health and full of determination. But I think he was a commander and not a politician. I don't think he would have really been able to have led the American people had he lived and returned and tried to, turn those military aspirations into political objectives.
Right. Yeah.
I don't think so.
Well, I mean, he probably would, because he tended to shoot off his mouth without a whole lot of introspection, he probably would have torpedoed his own campaign.
Precisely. I think so. I mean, George, and I think in the words of Omar Bradley, and Bradley even had reservations about appointing him to any type of political or military and political military hyphen between the two position, because he was just too inflammatory and basically didn't care a whole lot for the sake of his men. I mean, he was going to do something because he wanted to do it, and he didn't care how many people he killed or how many soldiers were going to be destroyed and whatever his efforts were. I mean, his efforts toward relieving Bastogne during the Battle of Bulge were, I guess we can call them heroic, but I will give the heroism to the men who fought underneath him and who had to implement those orders. But nonetheless, General Patton was, he was at the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
all there is to it.
Well,
just as John Kennedy was when his driver turned onto DV Plaza going too slow or not using the bubble top, or just as the Archduke was when his driver took a wrong turn in Sarajevo in 1914.
Right, and that is the larger point behind the morality of these O'Reilly books, Jim.
Is that they
create an alternate reality for people who haven't much interest in reality in the first place?
Well, you always have people who are going to try to put something else onto the stage of history that may not have been there. I mean, just for example, Princess Diana. I mean, when I was in Paris, I've been to that place where she was killed many a time, being driven by a taxi cab driver who was going too fast on the Place d'Alma. And I even thought, good Lord in heaven, this is not a place where I want to end my life. But the taxi cab driver was sober. He wasn't drunk. Or at least I didn't know.
Goes a long way, that.
Huh?
That goes a long way.
Yeah, it does. And, of course, that You're going to always have people who are going to generate conspiracy theories and movies that are going to be made and stuff like that. And I think Mr. O'Reilly basically is taking a lot of stuff he's seen on Hollywood about Patton's being hit by a rubber bullet or the history of the NKVD under Stalin and Beria generating all kinds of nice concoctions for people they didn't like. But I think Bill O'Reilly is just, like I said, an opportunist who's trying to make some money and trying to get a lot of people stirred up who have a limited knowledge of history. I would just love to see the bibliography of that book, particularly from the Soviet sources and stuff like that, and how they would be able to obtain such things. I mean, for example, they keep pieces of Hitler's skull. They just release that, you know, the one with the bullet hole, so they say. I mean, the Russians are pretty much, they keep all that stuff close to their chest. And there's not much of a way of getting into it, into the secret Kremlin archives or whatever. But I think that Mr. O'Reilly has just made a fool of himself. He always does. He,
well, but the real people being made fool of are the fools who go out and plunk down 1995 for that pile of dreck.
Now, I was told it was number one on Amazon.
It may very well be, but this is worth noting, Jim. Anytime a right-wing book rockets to the top of the charts, for instance, if you look for it on, say, the New York Times bestseller list,
mm-hmm.
you know that little symbol, the little dagger that they put there?
Oh, yeah.
That means purchases in massive bulk.
Yeah, I just wonder how many people have bought just crates of these books and set them aside.
Well, no, what they do is right-wing outfits purchase them by the crate.
That's what I'm saying.
At a discounted price, and then they send out their fundraiser. And if you'll send $5 to the Enterprise for Competitive Libertarian Freedom, we'll send you O'Reilly's new book. And then,
yeah.
And then a year later, when talking about this earlier, I got a note from Marty, and Marty said, I'll wait for Billow's tome to appear in the dollar bin at the old used bookstore before putting my dollar down. And that's what happens. They wind up at Dollar Tree and Dollar General and Family Dollar in the book section.
I've never heard any real, reportages as to where these books have wound up. I mean, they're like a Quixotic. They flash across the sky for a week or two, and then you don't hear anything about them anymore.
You know what? I dare and defy anybody to find me a radio program, progressive, right-wing, whatever, in the coming week in which anybody refers to Quixotic. It ain't necessarily me slapping funny, Jim, but I think there's a toaster in that one for you. But that is what happens. They do. They wind up in the dollar book bin at all these little and most, you know, they're cutouts or and a lot, and so there'll be a warehouse full of these things, and the right wing Competitive Freedom Institute for Libertarian Glory or whatever will donate them or sell them for pennies on the dollar and write it down on their taxes.
Well, what better way to get their message across than to put that book into so many hands as possible? You know, they do that. They do it all the time.
And frankly, they probably reach more people through the dollar book bin. And I can't tell you the number. I mean, I've seen the Palin book. I've seen Donald Trump books, you know, because we've got a Dollar General just down the road here. And it is. It's like a who's who of bad right-wing authorship.
They have Palin books there.
I've seen them, yeah.
Oh, God, the thought of Sarah Palin writing a book. Oh, my God.
I think I saw a copy of You and Your Corn Dog by Marcus Bachmann one day. It was a dollar.
Oh, speaking of Bachmann, can we execute a vote file here?
by all means, execute away.
Where is Palin? I mean, Michelle Bachmann going now that she's no longer going to be in Congress?
I don't know if that's a known. I don't know if there's an answer to that, but there will be a door open at some wingnut institute, and they'll pay her $500,000 a year to sit there and be stupid.
That has to be the most ridiculous, stupid person I have ever heard open her mouth.
Now, you know what? You're going to get hate mail from Sarah Palin. I mean, it was just last week when she said that she didn't want them liberals getting close to 1400 Pennsylvania Avenue.
Well, I'm talking about Bachmann.
I know, but I mean, you know,
I couldn't imagine sitting across a bridge table trying to play cards with those two.
No, but the Denali dipshit.
I clean them out.
No, the Denali dipshit takes a back seat to no one, Jim.
I guess you're right. I guess you're right. But nonetheless, I think that, I don't know. Mr. O'Reilly is full of shit. Sarah Palin is full of shit. Michelle Bachmann is just too stupid to be even called full of shit. I mean, she's just full of whatever. Excuse my language, but that's the way I feel. And, oh, by the way, I voted today.
Oh, did you?
Mm-hmm. Sure did.
The Koch brothers haven't managed to shut down early voting in West Virginia yet.
No, but they sure are trying. They sure got a decision in Ohio.
Yes, they did. They absolutely did.
Next week, I think.
The Supreme Court, and it was another 5-4 decision. The Supreme Court of the United States, the rats, have said, "Well, heck yeah, you can make it harder for people to vote. What do you want? People voting?"
Well, I had to get the Debo machines ready.
No, it really is much more. It's much more prosaic than that. It's just a matter of trying to keep the wrong people from voting.
Oh, I know.
But in all seriousness, this is the wave of the future. Because, as I've said before, I do look out there. I do try to sort of not forecast or prognosticate. But I try to look out into the future at things that are going to make a difference. And the 2020 census is going to be huge. And in point of fact, recognizing that the Republican Party, Jim, really is just a rump, angry old white people's party. And the only way it can ever maintain any kind of lasting control, since it is a minority party, is by making sure that the wrong people, as defined by them, don't vote.
Well, it's just patent dishonesty, basically, on their part. I mean, how many times have we gone through this in every election since 2000 or whatever? Ever since the election and whatever. I'll go further back than that. I mean, they'll do anything to restrict people from voting that they know will not vote, you know, for their candidates, and they're just incredible, adept, and in particular,
what they managed to put the kibosh on, Jim, was this idea of being able to register and vote early on the same day.
Oh yeah.
And so here's the fun part of it. This is actually not a full ruling. This is an appeals court. The Circuit Court of Appeals that handles Ohio had issued an order saying that there would be these new opportunities for voting. And the Supreme Court said, nope, we're just going to stay that. It ain't going to happen. We're going to make sure the voting takes place, but we haven't heard the whole case yet, so we might overturn this after the election. Everything is after the election. If one volt falls again, does that mean we're just going in the same direction we were going in the first place?
I guess so.
Okay, so maybe we want to do that hinge movement that Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain did on Little Round Top at Gettysburg, that 90-degree movement. Anyway, where was I going? Damn.
We're talking about bad practices in voting and the people who give them the ability to use appeals to...
Yeah. So the way it works out is that they can say, we'll take care of it after the election. Meanwhile, I don't know if you caught this or not, but in addition to having Bill O'Reilly on this week with George Snuffleupagus, John Boehner showed up.
Oh, dear.
And he was much more chilling, Jim. If you are someone who cares about someone who is in the military of the United States right now, he was absolutely terrifying.
Oh, I noticed that. Today.
He sat there and looked at the camera and said, I just don't see how we're going to do all this over there without some boots on the ground. Of course, they're not going to be my kids' boots on the ground. They're going to be yours.
Well, you know, the first thing, the sandals in the sand, and then a lot of other things, you know, helping the Kurds to fight ISIL and stuff like that. And those words came out of the mouth of KT McFarland, whom I do respect, and I've talked about her before. She was a senior advisor in the Pentagon, civil service rank of a three-star general, but no boots on the ground from her. But nonetheless,
and yet they're hollering for it, Jim. They're hollering.
Yeah, they are. They're hollering for one thing. It's called war and a renewal of our conflict in the Middle East, and it's just going to be a bloodbath, really. That's going to be a real bad thing.
Our blood.
That's right. Our blood, but not their guts. And you got some other people I know you want to talk to, so I'm going to get off here. And I've got a big cat that just jumped on me, so I'm going to have to move over and let him get his place of repose since he weighs 29 pounds.
Yeah, and when he sits around the house, he really sits around the house.
He does. He does indeed. But anyway, you take care. Have a good program. And thank you for the toaster. Congratulations on your existential victory. And I will say good night, sir.
All right. You take care, Jim. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Our buddy Jim calling from not so terribly far from here. And we will go back to the phone in just a moment here. A couple of notes along the way. This is the part that drives me crazy. You got John Boehner saying that there's going to have to be boots on the ground, and they're going to have to be our boots. John Boehner, in other words, wants to send the American military, American mothers and fathers, sons and daughters, American children's mothers and fathers, nieces, nephews, aunts, uncles, cousins, neighbors, friends, beloveds. John Boehner wants to stand there with his lit cigarette in one hand and his glass of Merlot in the other. And, God bless America, you all. Goodbye now. Go kill those headloppers. But he doesn't want to talk about it until January. He's the Speaker of the House of Representatives. He owns that calendar. If he wants to talk about boots on the ground, he is the Speaker. He is the person who speaks. And he can call the House of Representatives back into session. And if he had a single microgram of integrity in his entire being, he would. But he does not have that microgram. And he does not have the political fortitude it would take to have that discussion. Because the fact of the matter is, yes, the for-profit media have been beating the drum as hard as they can, waving the bloody shirt so that we're all beginning to get splattered. But they have not yet succeeded in getting this country whipped into a full-on war frenzy so that a guy with a bandana do-rag can stand outside a protest in St. Louis with a poster that says, "Get a brain, morons! Go you say!" Right? And I still haven't... I'm still waiting for the libertarians to get a big march going. Big anti-war march. Because, you know, libertarians always say they're against war. And American adventurism. And their hero is Ron Paul. Cranky old Ron Paul. Father of Rand Paul and quite possibly that thing on his head. But the libertarians are in kind of a bind now because Rand Paul is into it. He's for it. He wants it. Meanwhile, it remains, as it always is, to the liberals, the progressives, to be the ones who speak up for morality and for peace. Our buddy Dr. Allen wrote over the weekend, and he said, I enjoyed the chance to listen to your show today. Yes, there were many anti-war folks at the People's Climate March, including Code Pink. In fact, the Progressive Democrats of America were giving out stickers with the message, "Windmills, not weapons," which I think sums it up quite nicely. I was happy to wear that through the airport back to Waco. With 400,000 people there, the march was really fantastic. Six of us from Waco Friends of Peace attended, including my son and my significant other. So, yeah, we're out there. Sure would be nice if some of those principled libertarians would get out there with us, but don't hold your breath waiting for that. Oh, hell no. And we just a note here at 12 minutes before the hour, we are $30 away from matching... for matching our buddy Tom's call for a kick the lupine pest off the porch response, which I have noted we will use if we can raise, it's about $700 total. We'll use that for a gizmo that will allow, among other people, our buddy Bill, Mr. Stress, to join us on Friday on the front porch. Let's go back to the phone. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Jim was on tonight.
Yeah, he was. Speak of the devil.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad because I'm funny. I don't have this. I just, you know, Patton pulled his weight a lot of times, but he also, he pulled one thing that Jim probably knows about where he put together a flying column to try to get through to a POW camp where his son-in-law was being held. And it was a pretty much of a failure. And maybe he shouldn't have, you know, I don't know if he got clearance from above. I mean, who would that have been? The ground commander in France, farmer. How was his name? I'm going to see now.
Bradley?
Yeah. What?
Bradley?
Well, he's under Eisenhower, yeah.
Yeah, because Bradley leapfrogged Patton.
Yeah, Bradley, yeah.
Omar Bradley.
Yeah, Bradley. Yeah, because Patton got himself in trouble a couple of times and, you know, shooting his mouth off and pulling some stunts that, you know, I guess pretty nasty to guys in hospitals and such. And I don't think he was that well liked by everybody else around him. Now, sometimes success will breed anger, but, yeah.
Well, also, Bill, remember, Patton was a son of privilege.
Yeah.
I mean, he wasn't some poor little kid that came up from nothing.
No.
He was a pistol and fencing champion at the academy. He was from California, too.
Well, he was running armored vehicles when they ran the veterans protest march, you know, the guys looking for money, bonus marchers. He was running tanks during that engagement. So, of course, that doesn't fit too well with me anyway, being a working class person. Because I thought those guys, those bonus marchers basically were, and they were kind of, they actually set up some, they got along with the chief of police in Washington. Took a liking to him, and there was plenty of ball games between Washington police and bonus marchers, and, because they really didn't get that out of hand. But Hoover didn't want to talk to him. I mean, Hoover wanted to talk to anybody. That was another classic, this, Jerry Von Zell, you know him? Who he was? He was an announcer.
Oh yeah. Who was he the announcer for?
Yeah, well that was the.
Did he announce for Groucho?
I don't know.
Was it Burns and Allen?
Oh wait a minute, he was with. He might have been with Burns and Allen. Might have been their voiceover guy. I know he did some radio work, but his biggest mess up was he was introducing Hoover, and he said the President of the United States, Herbert Hoover. He screwed the guy's name up three times trying to pronounce it, and finally he said, "Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States." That was one of those classic.
I didn't realize that was Harry Von Zell.
What?
I didn't realize that was Harry Von Zell.
I think that's who it was. But somebody checked me because I can't Google. I'm sitting here and I just found out that to get this computer really rolling, I've got to go out and spend another $140 on a Zoom text package for the magnification of it. I have an old copy here, and I'm going to try it and see if it probably isn't going to run, though. Because you know how the boys run when they put together these new computers with the new operating systems, you know?
Yeah.
We want it, so you have to go buy something else. They have become like car manufacturers, you know?
Well, to a certain extent, it's just that, I mean, there are some... It's more than next year's model. A lot of this stuff has to do with the expansion of the technology. I mean, there's no way. I mean, I think back to my first Pentium machine back in the 90s. You know, that thing had an absolutely terrifying level of memory in it. I mean, it had a hard drive that was maybe 100 megs.
Yeah, true.
But if we want computers to do the stuff that we like for computers to do, it's all very resource intensive. So the more ways we figure out for computers to do stuff, the more resources we have to have for them to consume. I mean, that's why this production machine that I'm running on here, you know, sometimes I sit trying to run an audio clip and it working, you know, like the Star Trek voice. There's our reference for the evening.
Yeah, because my new text will get a funny voice after if it hasn't been shut down and restarted in a while.
This thing's I think 5 years old, and it's been on 365 days a year for those 5 years. I mean, I'm lucky that the CPU isn't just a little heap of slag.
Yeah. Well, I'm running an old XP program that's about a 12-year-old computer.
Yeah, you need. Well, yeah, we know you need to.
I've got a new one sitting here, and it's gonna start. A buddy of mine's coming to work on it this week, and we'll go from there.
Well, hot
I know
diggity.
I'm gonna have to go out. Pardon?
I said hot diggity.
Yeah, once he gets it rolling, then I have to order a new magnification. That comes, they'll send it to me on a disc. All I need to do is send them money, and they'll send me something that works nicely. Man, I thought car dealers were crooks, you know? But, I guess I'm right about that part, too. Car dealers, man, I'm telling you, Bob, those guys were, I think I used to love catching those guys because I knew enough about cars that only they laid some line that was so bad you were slipping on it, you know. I'd catch them. Yeah, but O'Reilly, how can anybody listen to this man and believe a word he says? Did he do any work
because of what John Cleese said in that clip at the beginning of the program? They're so stupid, Fox viewers are so stupid, they don't know what they are stupid. And then it's magnified by the fact that Bill O'Reilly, to them, sounds like what a smart person sounds like to a stupid person.
Yep. Well, he's a pain in the rear end, that guy, no doubt about that. But Jim came up with when he was talking about Sicily with the Englishman and Patton. Boy, I didn't know there was room enough on that island for two egos that size.
I think they both came to the same conclusion that there wasn't.
Yeah. But I know Patton's best work, I think, was, well, maybe the landings, but he was, when the Bulge kid broke out, he turned that Third Army around and helped break through to those guys and end that Bulge, put an end to that. He flanked them, and that's one thing I have a lot of knowledge of the Ardennes, because what the Germans were trying to do at the time of the Bulge was basically the same thing they did in 1940. Break through the Ardennes and go all the way to the ocean and cut the French and Americans, or the English and Americans in half. And Hitler didn't have enough damn gasoline to do that.
Nope. Here's a little piece of trivia for you. I just found, we have a family member who died in the Battle of the Bulge, and I had never known much about him. He was 26. It turns out he was the son of my great grandfather. He was 26 when he enlisted in the army, and he was absolutely dear. My mother and her sister and their brother all looked up to him. They called him Jimmy. It wasn't his name. They just called him Jimmy. All looked up to him like a big brother. He walked down and he enlisted. He didn't wait to get drafted. He walked down and enlisted in early 1942. And they sent him down to Louisiana. And he became a member of the 401st Glider Infantry attached to the 101st Airborne.
Oh, so he was probably landed at the Normandy invasion. He probably saw.
He fought his way all the way across Normandy through Operation Market Garden and was among those besieged at Bastogne, where he was killed.
Market Garden, that was a big error. Montgomery was, Yeah, they got to the one bridge, and there was a heavy German division that was resting. They were resting and refitting at that point at Arnhem, where the bridge was that they couldn't get across. And they couldn't. That was the last bridge. And there's a pretty good book out about it called A Bridge Too Far. He says they tried to do it all. So he was. That's where he died at Arnhem, or on the on that maneuver.
No. He died at Bastogne during the siege.
Oh, okay. Okay, yeah, 101st.
401st.
Way in there.
401st Glider Infantry. They were seconded to. I forget who. Maybe I forget who they were seconded to, but yeah, that's where he died.
See, the guy that was commanding them was an artillery officer. He's the one that when the Germans came up and asked him to surrender, he said nuts.
Yeah, that was McAuliffe, and that you know that
yeah,
was,
Tony McAuliffe. Yeah,
that was
yeah.
kind of off the cuff, and
yeah.
It had to, the answer had to be explained to the Germans. It had to be explained to the American command. It had to be explained to the British. It had to be explained to the media. And I don't even know if McAuliffe really knew what he meant by it.
Well, I'm not sure what he meant by it, but that's how it came out. But I'm not going to keep you. But, yeah, Patton was, I think Jim has it. He was kind of, he was into it. He wanted to keep the, he wanted to keep the show going and stay in it. And that's sometimes not the wisest. Stalin pulled a stunt where he kept three of his best army sitting around Berlin. And those are the guys that he shipped by rail opposite Manchuria. And they're the ones that went after the Japanese. Because they owed the Japanese any something they felt anyway because of that 1904 Russian-Japanese War.
Yeah.
So they trainloads of Russian soldiers were going east, and they were telling the people on the tracks, "Well, we're going to fight the I forget what they called the Japanese. I forget they had a slang name for them." But anyhow, I'll let you go, but it was good to hear Jim. If anybody is on track with this story, he is. There's no doubt about it. Take care of yourself.
You too, Bill. You too. And I'll let you know if we get the gizmo in place, and you'll be part of the Friday on the Front Porch conversation again.
Yeah. Good night now.
All right. Take care. Bye now. Our buddy Bill, Mr. Stress. Calling from Cleveland. Let's see here. Thanks to Carl, that puts us $20 away from meeting Tom's challenge. Like I said, we will dedicate all of that to buying the necessary gizmo to bring this, real honest to goodness telephony back into the process here. PayPal buttons at headonradionetwork.com. And so too is the traditional mail address. All this, this O'Reilly killing foolishness reminded me of the original murder mystery. Who killed Cock Robin? I, said the sparrow with my bow and arrow, I killed Cock Robin. Who saw him die? I, said the fly with my little eye, I saw him die. Who caught his blood? I, said the fish with my little dish, I caught his blood. Who make the shroud? I, said the beetle with my thread and needle, I'll make the shroud. Who'll dig his grave? I, said the owl, with my little trowel, I'll dig his grave. Who'll be the parson? I, said the rook, with my little book, I'll be the parson. Who'll be the clerk? There's where British English versus English will screw you up. Who'll be the clerk?
Aye, said the lock. It's not in the if it's not in the dark, I'll be the clock. Who'll carry the link? Aye, said the linnet. I'll fetch it in a minute. I'll carry the link. Who'll be the chief mourner? Aye, said the dove. I mourn for my love. I'll be chief mourner. Who'll carry the coffin? Aye, said the kite. If it's not through the night, I'll carry the coffin. Who'll bear the pall? We, said the wren, both the cock and the hen. We'll bear the pall. Who'll sing a psalm?
Aye, said the thrush, as she sat on a bush. I'll sing a psalm.
Who'll toll the bell?
Aye, said the bull, because I can pull. I'll toll the bell.
All the birds of the air built a sighing and a sobbing when they heard the bell toll for poor Cock Robin. Wow. Oh, by the way, a little moment from the Poetry Corner. This via our buddy Jay Cruiser. I get the idea that the climate change serves as the impetus for this. Jay Cruzan is a poet. He writes, so why should I cry for you or for I? Who gives a damn we're all meant to die? Climate brings hell, something you deny. So when the starved eat your flesh, how could I care less? You brought this fire down to your home, to your town. You think Jesus gives a fuck that you want him to come down? He told you that bill of goods, the one the rich sold you, would leave you to be eaten by beasts. I'll enjoy watching the feast. So what of your sons? Well, look at them now. They're food for the starved. Watch as their bodies are carved. So now you wish to awake? What makes you think that you can? You fucked the whole world, you pitiful man. Koch brothers? So let's keep it rolling and go back to the phone. Hey, welcome to the program.
What's good, Bob?
What's happening, Jim? Two Jims in a night.
Well, not two in a row. Not one two in a row. But anyway, that Koch Brothers thing, I've noticed that too the last couple of months with it. And you and I can't buy Koch Brothers crap, you know? That's crazy. And it reminds me, I remember seeing General Dynamics used to run commercials like that, usually on Sunday, on the Sunday talk, so-called chat shows, talk shows, whatever. I think my memory serves me right. But, it's so weird. I mean, I've noticed it too. They're just promoting how great and how they're really doing all these great things, and it's just total crap. I guess most people see through it. Or do you think it has some effect by brainwashing? You know, enough people see it enough time.
I think there's an element of that, and I think the word has gone out from on high that there shall be a full throated defense of the Koch brothers, and it was in action this morning on Morning Joe. They're wonderful people. They like ballet.
I caught part of that. I can't even watch Morning Joe that much anymore. I used to kind of be able to. Well, it kind of was a goof, kind of like I used to be able to watch Fox, but it's just so blatant. And, you know, even the whole Morning Joe crowd is, you know, they all, it's almost like it's scripted. I'm sure it is.
Well, it is scripted to the extent that these are talking points that are coming down from the, the right-wing Sinai from the right-wing Olympus. It just is. And you know, because the Koch brothers have operated, you know, they really did. They operated in the shadows for a very, very long time, Jim. And when they have their meetings where they lay out their dark strategy for the John Birchification of America, I mean, they have gunned up thugs to keep, you know, to keep the wrong people from getting in and finding out what they're talking about.
And this isn't, you know, this isn't the paranoia of late night radio and Bohemian Grove and the Illuminati and the learned and the protocols of the learned elders of Zion. These bastards really do have secret meetings in which they plot the destruction of the United States of America.
Yeah, well, see, the thing to me is it's so obvious that once they do that and do it, they're on their way to doing it, unfortunately. They're going to have no place else to live either. You know, that's what's so, I mean, it would be funny if, you know, 7 billion people didn't, you know, the human race didn't have, and all of the planet didn't have to end up dying, which seems like, you know, I mean, it's not going to happen today or tomorrow probably, but, you know, what you talk, 10, 15 years ago, we've already hit the tipping point. Did I hear that on some other show or something where, I think it was Hartman.
Well, yeah, and then there's the business with the release of permafrost methane, which is going to perma-F us.
Yeah. And then, you know, try and talk to somebody about it. If they don't know what you're talking about, or they think somehow the Koch brothers will fix it, and it's, you know, or some big corporation will fix it, and it's just not the way. I don't see it working out that way. But
right, and you know, Carol just pointed out something via Skype. She said, and the Koch brothers are whining that they're standing before a firing squad. Not with 99% of Americans standing in front of them to take the hit. And we really are. I mean, I'm sure, really, people with the money and the power that the Koch brothers have, do you really think that when they know that nobody's listening, that they don't look at each other and go, of course climate change is real, and of course we're causing it, but we're rich enough to survive it. F the proles. There's too many of them already.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. I guess because everything seems to go your way, you don't think it's going to ever end. It seems like, you know, some of the substantial, maybe majority kind of waking up, but I don't think there's any way, I don't know, I don't see how it can be stopped. It's really. I mean, just the fracking keeps on going.
Hey, I got some fracking fun for you too. Yeah, this is really special, and it comes out of here in West by Cole, Virginia, and you can't make this stuff up. Emily Atkin over at Think Progress reporting. 9 citizen environmental groups are urging West Virginia Governor Earl Ray Tomlin to reconsider his plans to let companies drill for oil and natural gas underneath the Ohio River, citing concerns that drilling and fracking could contaminate the drinking water supply and increase the risk of earthquakes in the region. No kidding. No, this is real. Companies in West Virginia want to frack the Ohio River.
Man, it's crazy. See, that's the other thing. Where's the water? Where are they going to take hydrogen and oxygen and combine the chemicals together to make water? Because the way they're going, they're going to fuck up the whole water supply, and that seems, you do need water to drink. I mean, you need air to breathe and water to drink, and they're screwing up with,
well,
up
right,
everything.
Right. And bear in mind, of course, that the entity that has, allowed the fracking, that said, oh, sure, you want to frack the Ohio River? Frack away. Frack you, buddy. Well, that's the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection. And these are the people who took from 8 a.m. until 11:30 a.m., 3.5 hours, to go to take a 10-minute drive to Freedom Industries from the home office of WVDEP. And it's also the same agency that kind of, well, you know, people were complaining about the licorice smell as far back as Christmas before the announcement of the disaster on January 9th. So how long would the Ohio River be polluted before the Johnny-on-the-spot West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection noticed?
Or decided to tell you.
Right.
Yeah, isn't this a great country?
And the reason being given for it, Jim, you're going to love this. According to Keith Burdett, who is the Commerce Secretary in West Virginia, we need to allow the drilling because our state budget's real tight. So,
I'm so tired of hearing about the budget. They should, all they got to do is tax the rich. You know, it's that I think it's Alan Lee 10 years after song, tax the rich, feed the poor. You know, till they're no rich no more. But that'll never happen. That's a
right.
60s acid trip, I guess. All right. Well, I'll let somebody else get through. I'll let me let you go.
All right, Jim. You have yourself a good evening. Take care.
Okay.
Now. Bye now. Raucous good time. Raucous good time on this Moran Monday. And we got more Morans. And being as how Jim just called us from Louisiana Stan, let's take a quick jaunt down to the sportsman's paradise. Oh, yeah. Why not? First, there's the matter of lunch. I don't think there's better eating to be had in the state in the United States than to go down Louisiana way and eat. At least it was that way before the BP Horizon disaster. And with regard to some things, it's still that way. Well, down around about Port Allen, Louisiana, there's a place called Bergeron's Restaurant. And it's owned by a fellow named Kevin Cox. And Kevin Cox announced that he would give a discount to armed law enforcement officers who came to lunch at his establishment. Well, this felt like discrimination to the God-fearing, Bible-believing, gun-carrying, freedom-protecting Wolverines! Citizens in and around Port Allen, Louisiana. And they got hold of Kevin Cox over to Bergeron's Restaurant and said, "Hey, you're going to let them gun-toting cops come in and get a discount for eating at your greasy spoon? We want a discount, too." Olivia Karambot brought her .38 caliber Smith & Wesson Freedom Protector so she could get her discount. She said, "There's so many people who are trying to take our guns away, and the government makes stricter gun laws. They forget that we really do. We're given the right in the Constitution to keep and bear arms." There's so many people who are trying to take our guns away, and the government makes stricter gun laws. When? Name one. Now, during the Obama administration, we have had a relaxation of gun laws so that you can carry your Freedom Protector into wilderness areas. Freedom. And then proprietor Kevin Cox said, I just need to see a weapon. I need you to be carrying a gun. As long as everybody has a gun, we're all the same size." Yeah, especially the guys, right? About a half an inch. "I keep hearing so much about people banning guns. Target's banning guns, and these people are banning guns. Don't they realize that's where the people with guns are going to go? I want to take the opposite approach. How can I make my place safer? My friends and relatives would come in with their guns on their holster. I felt good about that. Made me feel safer that they were there with their gun. So why not include all good citizens with the officers, too?"
If you have a gun on you, I'm going to give you a discount.
Terse and, in fact, succinct comes the response from our buddy Steve. Kevin Cox, subject line. Really, Bob? Fuck these people.
Well, see, that's the thing. If I got my gun on and you try to do that, I can protect freedom.
Nothing in there about Walmart banning guns. Of course, if you happen to be of dark skin, do not, I repeat, do not, don't even try to purchase a BB gun. Because some terrified white person's going to call 911, cops going to come in and shoot you in the back. And even if there is video evidence of that, a grand jury will not indict. And let's just be clear about something out of the case out of Ohio. The notion that that case was presented to a grand jury and a grand jury refused to return a true bill was put out there as a sort of lace doily over the notion that the cops had shot a guy in the back and everybody got to watch him die. When a prosecutor doesn't get a true bill from a grand jury, that means the prosecutor did not want an indictment from the grand jury. A grand jury room is a special place. There's a court reporter, a prosecutor, the grand jury, and the witness or witnesses. And it's up to the prosecutor who the witness or witnesses are. So if the cop comes in there and says, well, we got a 911 call. Wrong accent, I know. We got a 911 call, and we went into the Walmart store there, and we saw a Negro with what appeared to be a firearm, so necessarily we killed him. And the grand jury sits there and nods a little head and goes, mm-hmm. And the prosecutor says, well, you've heard the evidence. I'll leave you to decide whether or not to indict on this. Just let me know when you're done. And they all walk out of the room, and the grand jury understands they are not supposed to issue an indictment. Now, if the prosecutor had wanted the indictment, there would have been a parade of witnesses, and the grand jury would have had no choice. Because the old saying is quite true that a prosecutor, if he so desires, can get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich. Because you got to understand, in a criminal trial, the standard of proof that applies is beyond a reasonable doubt, and it has to be a unanimous verdict in almost all circumstances. That means everybody has to agree either guilty or not guilty. If they don't all agree, they wind up being a hung jury. Judges hate hung juries. Because that means they got to go through it all again. A grand jury proceeding is entirely different. A grand jury proceeding is, one, a lot more people than 12. You know, 18. It can be 18 and up, depending on the jurisdiction. And get this. Okay, so the evidence in the Ohio Walmart case was, and you know, there's no getting around the video. 911 call, man with gun. Cops show up, he has his back turned, he is not menacing with the BB gun, and they shoot him the hell down in cold blood. At a criminal trial charging even something like manslaughter, you would still have to prove that the cops were guilty of whatever charge it was beyond a reasonable doubt, which means almost certain. Not beyond any doubt. For instance, a juror could say, Well, I doubt if they did it because the transmissions I'm receiving through the fillings in my teeth tell me that it was aliens. That's not a reasonable doubt. Beyond a reasonable doubt means something entire. It is the highest standard in all of American jurisprudence. On the other hand, that grand jury that refused to indict in Ohio, all they had to find was that it was more likely than not that a crime was committed, and that the persons mentioned as defendants were more likely than not the people who committed the crime. That's an extremely low standard. But hey, grand jury proceedings are secret. So we don't get to know. Justice. Right? Oh, and one more little something-something from Louisiana, Stan. They're worried about a lot in Louisiana, Stan. I mean, they're worried about the killers, maybe from ISIL, coming into Bergeron's in Port Allen, Louisiana. I mean, it's Port Allen. They could come in on little rubber ducky swimming pool floaties that they've been bobbing on all the way from Western Asia, and just get up out of the bayou and come in and start a lopping heads. But they're not going to do it because everybody in Bergeron's is protecting freedom. But threats to our way of life, well, they come in many different varieties. There is, of course, the ongoing threat to traditional God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing Christian marriage. And down in Louisiana, Stan, there was a church that was got all head up and worried about the gay marriage. And so consequently, Westwood Baptist Church, in order to make sure that there was never any of that sodomizing gay marriage taking place in their house of holiness and worship, well, they just wanted to make sure that there wouldn't be none of that. So they had to get rid of every possibility that could ever result in any gay marrying going on, or any gay anything going on inside their sanctuary. Sanctuary. So over to the Westwood Baptist Church, they wrote a letter to the Keithville, Louisiana Alcoholics Anonymous group. That letter said, "As I'm sure you are aware, God's church, His written word, and its values and principles have come under a constant and aggressive attack from the homosexual and Lebanese community. Churches and Christian businesses alike across our nation are being forced by our legal system to accommodate these groups in the use of their buildings, facilities to perform marriage ceremonies, receptions, etc." And as a consequence of these fears, the Westwood Baptist Church kicked out the Keithville AA group, which it had hosted on its premises. No, really. Make sure none of them recovering alcoholic homos get secretly hold hands here in our sacred sanctuary and have a secret gay marrying commitment ceremony. I mean, that's the kind of thing that we're protecting from ISIL here in America. Because, you know, if the homosexuals get married, well, then ISIL's just going to come in and cut off, we'll get everybody killed, just like Lindsey Graham says. You know it. because ISIL really is going to get America. You doubt it? Well, just ask Andrea Mitchell. I mean, I'm sure that ISIL and them Khorasans. I mean, damnation! One minute they got them a reality show about women with big bottoms, them who they going to marry and everything, and the next thing you know, they lopping off heads. I can't figure it out.
Watch. Richard's reporting the video that we've been getting in. It's almost just like movies you see of the Civil War where people come out to watch a battle unfolding in front of them.
Yeah.
Right a couple of hundred yards away from them.
Yeah, I mean, it really does speak to the immediacy of the threat and how it's being felt by local citizens right there. Absolutely. And it also speaks to the brashness of this particular enemy, ISIL, that they are willing to still continue to fight out there in the open like that.
But to Richard's question, why aren't we just bombing the hell out of them right there?
Well, we are hitting targets up in the north.
We're not hitting people so much as we're hitting a tank here, an emplacement there. We're hitting APCs. We're not hitting troops or forces.
Well, it's a little bit of both right now, Andrea. I mean, the prime focus in Syria has been most of the last few days on strategic targets, things that get at their ability to sustain themselves. That's why we hit those oil refiners, and we hit more over the weekend. You're also starting to see the target list change a little bit in Syria to include some tactical targets as well, some vehicles and some checkpoints and that kind of thing. So we are mixing it up a little bit, and we are hitting them a little harder there in the north and still in Iraq as well.
You got that? Are you afraid enough yet? I mean, we're not hitting people. It's not war till you hit people. Sometimes people just need to be hit. Just ask Janine Pirro over to Fox News TV Radio Rwanda. She'll tell you.
Last night in my opening statement, I warned that American citizens are not prepared for an attack on our own soil. Here are some of your best responses. Susan says, this president has never done his primary duty in protecting our country. He daily seeks to undermine and divide it to suit his own power goals. And
oh, damn! I realize this is just coals to Newcastle and everything, but I seem to recall a little bit of a problem back when the last president and Count Dicula decided to downplay a certain daily CIA daily briefing that said bin Laden determined to strike inside the United States. And we lost how many people on September the 11th, 2001? And yet, Fox News TV Radio Rwanda is still hollering, George Bush don't keep us safe! Except for 3,000 people that wasn't so safe that day. But this president has never done his primary duty of protecting the American people. People who are so stupid, they don't know they're stupid. Welcome to Fox News. Thank you, John Cleese.
Of course, she's referring to the first order of government, which is the protection of its citizens. Dwayne says, you got guts. That's more than I can say about Obama. We need leadership now. And David says, Judge, you are 100% right. We need to be ready to defend ourselves. And he says, you are right on. I want to know what our country is doing to protect us. Are our borders safe? Are we just letting anyone enter the country? What's the plan? Here's the plan. Anybody can enter. Robin, why is it so hard for our government to do things the right way? Looks like we're still hearing the blame game. And Angie says, I know my family takes the threat of ISIS seriously. We are locked and loaded. Ray, our shores and borders have already been penetrated. Every one of us has to be vigilant in our neighborhood and on our jobs. Absolutely.
Because you never know when an ISIL, and you're not going to know them, They might look like a Mexican who might actually be a Guatemalan. And they might be there standing in the Home Depot parking lot looking like they're waiting for a job, and you come up to ask them if they'd like to come and scrub your toilets for you, and the next thing you know, they lop it off your head because it's ISIL, not Mexicans. And all you was going to do was offer them a few dollars, you know, nothing like minimum wage with any workers' compensation or anything. You're just going to bring them out, mow your lawn, swab your toilets and stuff like that. And the next thing you know, they're just sawing away on your neck. Got to be ready. The whole family. I mean, we got a threat here in America. It's time to teach the toddlers to shoot. Oh, wait, we already do that, and sometimes they shoot each other. Be ready, America. ISIL is coming. They's coming, I tells you. And they're going to leave your local Wally World a heap of smoking rubble. Because they hate us for our freedoms, which we get in container ships from China. God bless America.
And says if the Obama administration won't do it, we Americans must band together to protect ourselves from the terror here on our soil. Very true words. And now for the results of tonight's Insta poll. We asked you, how are you preparing for a possible terrorist attack in America?
Well, first, we've laid in a supply of Koch Industries toilet paper, because we is fairly pooping ourselves over here over the thought that ISIL is going to come through precious Lumpkin's window and start us hauling at her noggin. No, really. Tell us, Judge Jeanine. Jesus Christ, was this woman really a judge? Did she really sit on a bench in judgment of people? Wonder how many people spit on the ground at the mention of her name every day. By the way, back to Port Allen, a note from Danny. Hey, Bob, I haven't been able to listen, sadly, but we'll later. Did hear about the reference town and the gun fools. I call it Port Allen, just across the Mississippi River from downtown Baton Rouge. Oh, how about a food porn report on the cuisine at Bergeron's, Danny? If you just, you know, if you're out there on the road. Steve with a couple of notes. He says, in regard to why aren't we hitting their troops? That's because there aren't troops, you dumbass! And I pushed Steve over the line. It's official. I just can't listen anymore. I don't know how to be this fucking afraid. Isn't it pitiful what a chicken shit nation Fox is turning us into? Or trying to? Guess what? There's a little bit more than a minute left of Jeanine Pirro here. How to prepare for ISIL. Oh, do I really have to say this? Get the duct tape and the hockey puck out, okay? You're probably going to be doing some grinding on this one.
Wendy says, I am locked and loaded. Let them in if they can get past my guns. Felicia says, I ordered a 3-month supply of food storage, ordered 1,000 rounds. Now I just live as normally as I can. And Becky says, by being...
Which ain't very... Because, see, she wasn't normal, the woman with the 3-month supply of food, stores, and 1,000 rounds of ammunition. God damn, that was almost early Kyler, wasn't it? She wasn't normal before that. Now she's less so, but she is truth-telling. She's being as normal as she can. Can't you see these terrified little Fox News TV radio Rwanda viewers serpentining to the mailbox every day? Serpentine, Sheldon! What? Serpentine! ISIL! U.S. Treasury armored truck. And as they're being picked up by a giant electromagnet on a crane... The driver of the truck in 1978 yells, Jesus Christ! Arabs! I bet it's Arabs! That was 1978. That was a comedy. This ain't funny.
Overvigilant and being prepared to defend myself and my home if necessary, then leaving the rest up to God. Susan says, I've been practicing at the gun range, and I just bought myself a pretty pink pistol. What was it, a Ruger? I've seen that Ruger.
Oh, dear. Now her husband will have to use the pink pistol, and he'll stuff it into his pants going into the shopping center in Arizona and blow his tiny todger off. Them pink pistols. I mean, I understand marketing. And me, call me crazy, I kind of like pink. I think pink is pretty. I was walking through Lowe's the other day, and they're selling, like, pink cordless drills and pink Dremels. I think it's kind of cool that these people are acknowledging that women fix things and use tools and stuff. But does it really sell more of the damn things to make them pink? By the way, my apologies for the recent outbreak of buffering. It seems to have been resolved. You know, you're going to have that once in a while. And the beauty of this new connectivity is that it really happens once in a great while, as compared to the incompetent service rendered by the fine folks at Shentel Cable, who could fuck up a one-car parade. Shentel! All right. 37 seconds. Hang on.
Anyway, Kat says, I'm stocking up on ammo, but I'm not going to let them change my routines and outlooks. And you better buy them before Homeland Security and everybody else does. Carol says, target practicing and praying.
Dear Jesus, guide my hand as I pump these rounds into that paper target of the outline of the ISIL Muslim. Guide my sights, Jesus. Guide my hand, Lord, when the ISILs come up our street, and help and remind me, Jesus, to lick my thumb and flick the front sight just like your servant Sergeant York done in that movie. And guide me, Lord, to shoot them from behind, from the back of the line, so the one in the front will never know what hit him. And remind me, Jesus, to holler, just like Sergeant York done as I'm a-leaning out the kitchen window using the sill as a bench rest and a living room throw pillow for padding. Guide me, Jesus, I'm a-praying.
We all need to have situational awareness. Don't put yourself in a situation where you don't have an escape plan or the ability to defend yourself. And Jason says, going to purchase a gun or two. Can't depend on the current government to protect me. And that's it for us tonight. Remember.
Shut the f*** up. I mean, she said, can't depend on the government to protect us. And she's smiling like a fox eating shit out of a wire brush. If only there... Meanwhile, Moran nomination as we roll down toward the end of the program, Moran nomination for the fine folks at the Secret Service. It was recently discovered that a Secret Service agent who looked and said to his Secret Service supervisor, boss, I think somebody's done shot a bullet into the White House, was responded, the response came, nah, it's just car backfiring. And then a maid or serving staff, whatever, at the White House looks up and says, Bless my soul, there's a bullet hole in the ceiling here. Yeah. And so there is some concern. May I point out, just as a matter of hanging on to history, may I point out that it wasn't very far into the presidency of Barack Obama that a bunch of Secret Service people got busted for sending around jokes, you know, jokes, fried chicken jokes and watermelon jokes, those kinds of jokes about the guy whose life they and family they were sworn to protect. May I remind you in all of this that the assigned code name for the president is the name of a song about a lynching renegade? I don't mean to get all paranoid and everything, but you know, really. Oh, and thanks very much to Jenny and to Sal. We are now $15 away from meeting Tom's Back on Your Heads challenge. Coffee breaks over, back on your heads. You know the joke, right? $15 away, and we will use that money, hopefully in conjunction with other money, to bring the telephony back into line so that we can take phone calls via a medium other than Skype. It's doable. Most problems can be solved. It just requires money to solve them. So there we are. Money. How do we wind this all up this year, Moran? Oh, let's stay with the general gun fun theme. Because this is a real laugh riot. GQ will be having GQ has a profile of George Zimmerman and his family coming up in their next issue. Amanda Robb is the reporter. And she details what has happened to the family in the wake of George Zimmerman's decision to end the life of young Trayvon Martin for the capital offense of carrying a can of Arizona tea and a bag of Skittles. And there are some real gems. Among other things, George Zimmerman's brother Robert wants us to feel sorry for George because it is reported that George has developed PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, or post-traumatic stress syndrome. Everywhere George Zimmerman goes, he's carrying a gun. Paranoia is flowing through the Zimmerman family like a mighty river. Bob Zimmerman is father of George and Robert. Bob says, I'm sure there are people, you know, some young kid that has nothing going for him, but he's able to get a pistol, wants to make a name for himself. Maybe I'll kill one of the Zimmermans. Maybe George. Maybe one of his family members. I'll be famous. You know, that happens. That's what worries me. Ooh. I think we're going to need a clip full of Thorazine darts in this case. The family in the GQ article says that they travel everywhere they go under assumed names now. They've sat and watched a movie, Argo, so that they could learn how to live like CIA operatives, like spies. Robert Zimmerman says that George identifies now with duct tape, hockey puck. George Zimmerman identifies with Anne Frank. Yeah, Devin, an entire belt of Thorazine darts. Just yeah. And they've learned how to be all sneaky and covert and spooky and stuff. Robert Zimmerman said, for instance, you never say, you know, if you got trouble, you never say, get a gun. You say, get the baby. Because if you say, get a gun, that alerts the bad guys. Oh, Margaret. And then there's George himself. Question having been asked of Pa Zimmerman, he answered that if the FBI, if an investigation was to result in a civil rights violation charge against George and the FBI come to arrest him, Bob Zimmerman said, he's worried that if FBI agents come and kick in his door, he's probably going to shoot a few of them. Whoa. You think if an indictment was handed down for civil rights violation, they wouldn't permit George to simply come and surrender? I mean, it does happen. Oh, sure, there are door-kicking episodes, but usually that's done to 90-year-old grannies in Atlanta. And people who are asleep with their children when the no-knock comes. I mean, it's not like George Zimmerman's Alien Gonzalez, right? And the whole family has gunfighter syndrome. I wonder when they go to the rest. I wonder if when they go to a restaurant, they sit with their backs to the door, and they've learned not to answer anybody hollering their names. I wonder if they're when they're sitting around playing cards, and somebody has aces and eights in their hands, they go, "Oh shit." And they're living in hiding, you know, because some punk might want to come and make a name for himself by being the guy who took down George Zimmerman. You know, just like being the guy who took down Jesse James. Or, Jesse James was a criminal. What up? But remember, I mean, George ought to have plenty of guns because remember that Ohio Freedom Protector group managed to buy him lots of new guns. Lord God, Billy Bob. So, I guess that brings us to the end of the program this evening. $15 away from meeting Tom's challenge so that we can bring more telephony back to the program and increase the number of people participating. Won't that be cool? I'm looking forward to it. Thank you, Tom. And thank you to everyone who responded. To Michael. And Jenny. And Sal. To Terrace. And Jay Cruzen and Twisted and Carl, thank you very much this evening. It's deeply appreciated, and I know the people who are able to call in on traditional telephony will be happy to do so. It'll help make an especially big difference on Friday on the front porch. Oh dear God, Titanic Tuesday is tomorrow. And I have a feeling we've got plenty to work with tomorrow as well. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy, moderators in the Horn chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to John Fox in Australia. Thank you to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thank you to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and AICACT.org. A reminder, a week from tonight begins All in America Coal, a feature series that will run all week on All In with Chris Hayes. I'm really looking forward to it. I hope you are as well. Spread the word. Chris's program deserves a much wider audience. And always, always, always. Gina, it's all for you.